This is concept number 33, the same age that Jesus was when he died. Focus, fixing your eyes upon Jesus. All right, this is a good study tonight. I spent lots and lots of time on it this week, and hopefully it'll come out right and make some sense to you. We're moving into our segment 5, which will be concepts 33 through 41. And the first one in this segment is the segment is going to deal with focusing our eyes upon Jesus. Who is Jesus? Who is this magnificent person we're supposed to focus our eyes on? And so this concept number 33 is introductory to the next several, and we're going to move away from the experience of faith that we've been talking about to now talk about the focus of faith. In other words, now that we have eyes to see with the eyes of faith, what are you supposed to set your eyes upon? What is the focus of your gaze? And so we'll look into that. Now, we're going to set the context for this topic. And if you have a Bible that with you and you want to follow along, then turn to Hebrews, the last part of chapter 10. Last part of chapter 10. And what we're going to do is we step into a lengthy narrative that runs for several verses from Hebrews, the last couple of verses of Hebrews 10, all the way through Hebrews 11, and then into the first couple of verses of chapter 12. And all of this runs together, and you want to see it together for this part of this Hebrew epistle to make sense. So in Hebrews 10, 38 and 39, and we looked at this passage some time ago when we first were on this particular topic. Now, I want to come back to it tonight just briefly. It says, "But my righteous one shall live by faith, and if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who shrink back to destruction, but who have faith to the preserving of the soul." Now, the passage starts out with the verse that we looked at for the last several weeks, "The righteous man shall live by faith." And then it talks about shrinking back or pulling back or withdrawing from the race of faith. And it says that if we pull back from walking by faith, that God will have no pleasure in us. And it goes on, though, to end on a positive note, where it says, "But we are not of those who shrink back to destruction, but we have faith to the preserving of the soul." And this is a church that's struggling along, has lost its way, has become sluggish and backslidden, and the writer of Hebrews is trying to awaken them, trying to wake them up. So he says, we're not going to shrink back to destruction, but we're going to press on to the preservation of the soul. And so the word shrink back here means to disengage, pull back, or withdraw. The word pleasure means to please. And so if we pull back or withdraw, then God takes no pleasure. God is not pleased with us. The word destruction means ruination or perishing of the soul. And then preservation means gaining as opposed to losing. We are not going to shrink back to destruction, but we're going to have faith to the preserving or the gaining of our soul. We're going to keep moving forward in this, and we're going to get to where we need to go. Now, after he finishes on this note with his final warning of we're not going to shrink back, we're not going to pull back, then we get into Hebrews 11, where we're given a definition for faith. It says, faith is the assurance of things hoped for and the conviction of things not seen. In other words, paraphrased, faith is a firm persuasion of what is and a confident anticipation of what is to come. So faith is the ability to perceive the invisible and to envision the unrealized. And this chapter 11 starts off with this definition, clarifying what is he talking about. And then we get into faith's hall of fame, which we looked at briefly. And Hebrews 11, 1 through 40, where we then cite multiple Old Testament examples of people who walked by faith and lived by faith and did amazing things. It says, by faith, Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, etc., by faith, all of these people did amazing things. Did I skip something?
You just went real fast and we all fell.
Oh.
We're good.
We're sharing.
You got it?
I did. They're sharing.
One more? That one?
Yes.
All right. Excuse me. I beg your pardon. I didn't realize I was charging forward at such a...
You were when you're trying to write big words.
Okay. All right, y'all got this page? Yep. Table number four, you good? Y'all good down there? All right. Definition of faith, paraphrased. Big words here, huh? Definition of faith. Got it? Vaughn, you got it? All righty. You sure? All right. Okay, now... Son, the Zoom is not right on this, but there's nothing to write in on this one, right? So y'all are good? All right, we looked at Hebrews 11, and we've got all of these people that did wonderful things for God, and they did them all by faith, and they all gained approval by their faith, even though this group of people that did such incredible things still had not received the promise. They were anticipating the promise to come, but still hadn't received it. Where we're living on the other side of the promise, we have realized the promise. And so how much better off should we be than these people who did such fascinating and amazing things? So he's gouging these sluggish Hebrew believers into realizing you have so much more to work for. How can you possibly justify the lethargy that's happening in your spiritual life? Come on, gang. You got to stir it up. So then we come to this passage. And this is the first two verses of chapter 12. And we're going to zero in on this passage tonight, look closely at this, because it instructs us on, again, where our faith is to be focused and the object that we're supposed to place it on. And so Hebrews 12, 1 and 2 reads as follows. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us. And let us run with endurance the race that's set before us, fixing our eyes upon Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Now, we're going to take this two-verse passage and we're going to break it down into six different parts because there's six pieces that comes with this. And then this will give you the gist of the passage. And the main thing you want to see in this passage in the Bible is that in order for us to get out of, or in order for the church that's being written to get out of their spiritual deadness and their lethargy, they have taken their eyes off of Jesus. And the failure to stay focused on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, that is where we get off track and we lose energy and steam and motivation in our walk with God. And whenever we drift into these patterns of spiritual lethargy and sluggishness, there a lot can be said about it, but one thing is always certain about it. You've lost sight of the champion of your faith and you've taken your eyes off Jesus and you've lost your way. So he's trying to get them to come back to that, and we're gonna unpack this passage with all that goes with it. Now, the author turns to the world of sports and borrows the imagery of spectators, apparel, participants, and conditions of the competition. The Olympics were happening back at the time that the New Testament was written. So it's hard to imagine that, but 20 centuries ago, Olympics were a big part of the way they did life. And if you won an Olympic gold medal back then, you were exempt from military service. You didn't have to pay taxes the rest of your life. And your kids got free education. It was a big deal. So naturally, the people who competed gave it everything they had because the benefits were so rich and enormous. I mean, you would be set for life if you ever won a gold medal. But it wasn't just the Olympics games, but there were also games that were held all over the Mediterranean basin. And so the sports analogy is one that was alive in the minds of these people. So we're going to build off of that now as we look into this passage. So here we go. Hebrews 12, chapter 12, verse 1 starts with this phrase. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us. Now, who are these witnesses surrounding us? Who's this great cloud of witnesses? Well, which ones were mentioned in? Hebrews 11. You got all those people mentioned in Hebrews 11 that went before us. And now they've finished the race and they're up in heaven. And so we are surrounded by this great cloud of witnesses that are watching and hoping that we're not going to quit and we're not going to stop in the middle of the race, but we're going to finish just like they did. So let's move into this idea and understand it a little bit better. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, we're going to look into this in detail. So here's where you get to take your notes. Therefore, the verse starts with the phrase, therefore. And you always ask when you see that in the Bible, what is that therefore? Right in? Okay, this therefore is there because it is a triple compound particle that draws an emphatic, dramatic conclusion. In other words, this is the concluding verse from Hebrews 11. And when you go through the New Testament, the way they've broken down chapters and verses, they're not always sensitive to the continuation of thought. They're just trying to arrange the Bible in a way that you can find verses quickly. But this passage starting in the 12th chapter, you always tend to think that a new chapter means a new thought, but that's a complete reverse of what's intended here. What's actually intended is that this verse brings us to the conclusion of the previous 40 to 45 verses. And so here's the conclusion. The conclusion is that we have, because we have as of now, it's a causal participle here, as a result of all that those people went before us have accomplished, we have so great, and the phrase so great refers to such a great, such a one so great as this. This cloud of witnesses is just enormous. It's magnificent. Yes, sir? What is that right there? Well, it means that the word has three pieces in it. And in the Greek language, when you've got compound words, that intensifies meaning. That's the idea behind it. And this is a triple compound particle, which is a rarity because particles are usually one syllable words. You got it in a triple form. That means it means saddle up, gang. Look at this. Therefore, here's our resounding conclusion we're reaching here. We have so great, one so great as this cloud of witnesses. Now notice this word cloud here. It's a distinct word. It's not like there's just a generic word for cloud in the New Testament. But notice this word refers not only to a great throng of people, but also it refers to those that are unified in the collective witness to their cause. So whenever the phrase was used back in the day, when it talked about a cloud of witnesses, it referred to a group of people that was a large number of people who agreed on the same idea. And the cause that's being brought out here is the cause of faith. So he's talking about faith, and this cloud of witnesses are testimonies to that faith. And so they are unified in their collective witness to that cause, and these people are surrounding us and we're enveloped by them. So they're looking down upon us in our journey, and these people are championing our cause, the cause of faith. These people are witnesses, one who attests or confirms a certain reality, sometimes even by their death. The word for witness, the Greek word, means martyr. So it referred to people who testified to something to be true and sometimes sealed the truthfulness of their witness with their own blood. Yes, ma'am.
The notes here.
Yeah. You must have the edited version. We'll see if it matches.
I think that S up there is sky.
Yep.
And what's the P in the other S?
I wish I could tell you. Is it this?
No, it's under worship. There's also a P blank and an S blank.
He finished the race and became
participants.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Participants who finished the race and became spectators of those still in the race. There you go. Participants who finished. Okay, so these witnesses are people who confirmed what they are testifying to, even to the point of their own death. And these people are surrounding us, which means they're spread all around, and it's an all-encompassing view. In other words, these people are looking at us from all different directions. There are all these people looking at us from all different directions, and their eyes are fixed on you. And they want to see how you are going to do. And these are people that have finished. They've run the race with all the rigors and all the challenges and all the difficulties. And they've finished. They've crossed the finish line, and now they're up in the stands watching. Look at these pictures here. Well, they'll come up in just a minute. You know what? How much time y'all got?
However much time you need.
Let me go change this PowerPoint. Because I don't think I've got... Yeah, I've got some stuff that you don't have. And this is going to confuse you if I don't get this right. So we're going to stop. Now, we were looking at this phrase. And this should correspond to what you've got in your notes.
Thank you.
Got everything? Okay. Therefore, since we have, because as of now, so great or one so great as this cloud, the image is not of a single cloud in the sky, but of a single cloud that covers the entire sky, referring not only to a great throng, but also to those unified in their collective witness, who are martyrs, one who attests or confirms to reality, participants who finished the race and became spectators of those that are still in the race. Okay. So, this group of witnesses are those that have gone before us, completed their number of times around the track, and now they have taken their place up in the stands as spectators of those that are still in the race. And so we are surrounded, which is a phrase which means they're all around us. Everybody around us is looking at us from all these different directions to see how we're going to do. So all these eyes are on us. And that has a stirring effect upon you if you think about it. Now, here's a picture of what we're talking about. This is the Grecian ancient stadiums were normally like this end here. They were just one half of a circle. And the activity took place, the competition took place down here in front. The Roman stadiums, on the other hand, were elliptical. They were full circles. So what you see here is one that's not fully a circle, but you kind of get the picture of witnesses looking down upon the tracks at the races. Here's another picture. This is the Hellenistic or the Grecian style. And look how many rows there are in those things and how high people up were, and it must have been built in a valley and the competition took place in the bottom. And here's an ancient picture. And these are in different places, mainly in Greece and in Turkey, where you see this is the full circle. And so imagine that you are racing around the track and all of these people that have finished the race are in the stands watching you. And they're up there sort of clapping and hoping that you're not going to quit, that you're not going to give up. And when you get tired and you start slowing down and getting weak and you think about quitting the race, all these people up there saying, go, 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 don't stop now. Press on. You got to get to the finish line. So that's the picture. Now, since we have this great cloud of witnesses surrounding us, here's the admonition. And that is to lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which entangles us. So let's look at this phrase. The word lay aside means to remove as a garment, shed, take off, or lay down. And the imagery here is of athletes who put on their athletic attire to run the race, and they dressed in only the minimal clothing that was for comfort and flexibility. So if they added extra clothing while they're running the race, all it did was slow them down. So they dressed appropriately to be able to go at the highest rate of speed, and not only speed, but also flexibility. Lay aside every, which refers to any and all, weight. Anything represents a weight to you. In a race, anything that's heavy is what slows you down. So anything that burdens you so that it's harder to run your fastest, then you want to put that aside. So it says, lay aside every encumbrance, and the word encumbrance means what, anything that weighs you down. It refers to a mass or a bulk that weighs a person down, hence an obstruction. The weight itself is a hindrance to running. And then the analogies that we're talking about here are athletes stripping off any unnecessary clothing to increase speed and agility. Bikers dropping water bottles at the end of the race right before the finish line. You know, bikers in long races carry bottles of water, and they drink that water so they keep from getting dehydrated. But toward the end of the race, when they don't need the water anymore, they discard it so that they can fly toward the finish line. So what was it used to them at one point toward the end of the race is no longer useful to them, but rather it's an obstruction, and so they get rid of it. And that's an analogy that talks about what this is asking us to do. Lay aside the encumbrance. And then it mentions the sin that entangles us. And the word sin here refers to anything. It's just a generic word for sin. And it refers to anything that represents disobedience to God. Anything that's taking us away from God's highest and best for us, we're to lay that aside. And notice the way this is described. It says, lay aside the sin which so easily entangles us. Now, this is a very dynamic and interesting word. It means, it refers to something that cleverly places itself around in a constricting, controlling way. Best image I could come up with was how a boa constrictor wraps itself around a person, and then at just the right moment tightens itself around the person, and at that point you can't get it off. And you might have been casually interacting with the snake, but once that thing gets around you and it starts constricting, you're caught. It has a suffocating effect upon us. And so it becomes a snare. And what it's referring to here is how sin does that to us. Sin is something you can easily flirt with or engage with, and then the natural thing for sin to do is just take hold of you. And once it's got you, it's just so much, much, much harder to get it off than when you're keeping it at a distance before it ever gets into your heart. It's what naturally just grips you and takes hold of you. It does it very easily. And the way it's translated, it says, lay aside the sin which so easily or naturally entangles us. So we're supposed to run the race here. And we've got this big cloud of witnesses who are all people that have made it across the finish line. And these people are up in the stands cheering for us to get to the finish line. And what we've got to do in the meantime is lay aside any encumbrance or weights that are slowing us down, anything that's hindering our spiritual journey, we get rid of that and the sin which so easily entangles us, and we run the race. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. So let's look at this phrase. Let us run means to move forward rapidly, make forward progress or advance. In the races, you don't have people, in the games rather, you don't have people just kind of walking in a meandering way around the tracks. When you see people on the racetrack, they are focused on the finish line and they are putting everything into moving as quickly as they can from the starting point to the finish line. So you don't have people walking casually or taking their time, but they're making rapid progress. So he uses the term run here, and it says to run with endurance. And the word endurance here means to run in such a way that you refuse to quit, staying the course in spite of difficulty or discouragement. No matter how tired you get, no matter how far it seems that you seem to be from the finish line, there is that resolve inside that you are not going to stop. Nothing is going to bring you to the point where you don't want to stay in the race any longer. Run with endurance the race. This is the word, comes from the word agonai or gonai, which refers to the race, which is that agonizing course that you run to get from the beginning to the beginning point to the finish line. It's clearly an athletic term. And the race that sets before us, this word is similar to a word we encountered earlier, and it means the race that's lying in front of us. Same root word for the word surrounding us, hence the route from the starting point to the finish line. And as you're standing at the beginning point, at the beginning of the race, you look down and there's the track in front of you. And it's laid down for you in front of you what you're supposed to do, and it lies before you. And so we are to run the race that is before us or that lies before us. And then here's what it tells us to do. Fixing your eyes upon Jesus. The finish line, or the person who's at the finish line, is what we're supposed to be focused on. We're not to be focused on the journey or the race itself, but we're supposed to be focused on getting to the finish line. And Jesus represents the finish line. Fixing our eyes upon Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith. Now let's look at this phrase closely. The phrase fixing our eyes means to look away from one thing and to concentrate on another. In other words, when you're running the race, you've got your eyes on the finish line, and you're not waving at people that are up in the stands or looking at the sky noticing what a beautiful day is, but you're riveted on getting to the finish line. So it says to look away from everything else and concentrate on this one thing, giving your attention to one thing to the exclusion of others. And it refers to having a total focus. Fixing our eyes in a completely focused way upon Jesus, who is the author and perfecter of our faith. The word author refers to the one who pioneered, the one who's gone first, the originator or the founder. The word archegos, the Greek word for author, is the word for architect. And an architect is one who conceives and builds something. So Jesus is the architect and the builder of our faith. And the word perfecter means the one who completes or brings to its full potential and final goal, which is crossing the finish line. So according to this phrase, we are to fix our eyes upon Jesus, who is the architect and the perfecter, or the one who brings our faith to its full maturity and enables us to cross the finish line. So we lay aside everything that weighs us down, lay aside the sin that encumbers us, and we run the race with this determination to not ever quit. And with that refusal to quit, we are focused on, we keep our eyes upon Jesus, who built and is perfecting and maturing our faith. And our faith is what we've said, our belief in God. And then we have two more phrases that go with this. In looking to Jesus now, Jesus, who for the joy set before Him endured the cross, despising the shame. And now what's being spoken of is how Jesus is the example of the one who's gone before us, and how Jesus ran a course which is such a higher degree of difficulty than we will have to run. And He was able to finish. So in the sense that He finished, then we should be able to finish our less demanding race. Notice it says, for the joy set before Him. The word joy here is a general word for gladness. Jesus ran the race with a certain gladness. Interesting thought, huh? You usually don't run races or participate in athletic competitions with a lot of joy in your heart because it's just so demanding. But there was a joy that Jesus carried with Him. And it was a joy that was not so much with Him, but it was in front of Him. And it's the joy that you experience when you finish something. It's the joy you experience when you complete something. So it's that great feeling that's there when you get to the finish line. And it was the joy of finishing that was before Jesus that allowed Him to endure which means to refuse to run away from, hold steady to the end, who actually endured the cross, which was the means of his execution. And when you think about suffering and pain and discomfort, crucifixion back in the day was the most brutal form of punishment known to the people of that time. And it was specifically designed to inflict maximum pain upon a person and stop just short of driving them into unconsciousness. Because if they became unconscious, they couldn't experience the pain. So the idea was to inflict maximum pain upon somebody, but stop short of driving them to be unconscious when they would be out of pain. So Jesus had to go through that means of execution, which was in terms of cruel and unusual punishment. I mean, it was just, it's unimaginable what he went through. But Jesus endured that because there was a joy at the end of the finish line that he was put his heart on. And he endured what he had to endure to get to that joyful finish line. And it speaks here of despising the shame. And crucifixion was for the worst of the worst of the culture. And so Jesus had to Jesus viewed contemptibly or hated the shame and disgrace that was associated with being crucified. And so the horror of what Jesus had to endure, which was the worst human punishment imaginable, Jesus hated every minute of that. He didn't enjoy that shame and disgrace for one minute. But what kept him going was what was waiting for him at the end of the line, at the finish line. And so what keeps us moving forward is, in a sense, the joy of heaven, which is going to be so much above and beyond anything we will have ever experienced here. And when Jesus finished the race, this is what he did. It says he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Jesus reached the finish line. And this was what was waiting for him. Let's look at this phrase. The word sat down means to take one seat and remain there. The seat that's at the right hand refers to, the word here is dexios, which means right versus left, but it symbolizes equality of position, honor, power, and authority. In other words, for Jesus to sit on the right hand of God places him on equal authority, power, and dominion with the king who sat upon the throne. When you are the king's right-hand man, what belongs to the king belongs to you. So this is a position of honor. There's only one person who sits on the right hand of the throne of God, in that of any king, and in this case, it's the throne of God, which is Jesus. And the throne of God is the seat of heavenly power and divine authority over all creation. And so Jesus went from the lowness, the debasity of the cross, all the way to the right hand of God in heaven. So it was as if he went from the lowest of the lows to the highest of the highs. And the idea is to fix your eyes upon Jesus. And the comparison goes something like this. You think you got it bad? No matter what you're going through, just remember what he went through. And if he, the author and perfecter of our faith, went through this awful horror, trauma, drama of the cross and is now seated at the right hand of God, if he endured all of that, the passage goes on to say, you haven't endured to the point of shedding blood yet. You haven't gotten to the point of what Jesus went through. So you keep your eyes on him and let him inspire you, no matter what you're going through, to get to the finish line. Now, this passage is a mouthful, and I'm sorry that I didn't have the right PowerPoint to make it flow a little more smoothly. I know that's distracting, and I apologize for that. But let's make some observations now from the passage. The passage speaks in the first person. It says, let us lay aside, let us run, since we are surrounded by so great a crowd of witnesses. It's speaking to us in the plural. It refers to us as a group of believers. So it's not speaking to us as individuals, but speaking to us corporately. We, the church right now that are on the racetrack, we're surrounded by all these people looking at us, these champions of the faith that have done amazing things, and they're cheering us on, and now they're cheering us on as a group to run the race together and to finish it. We are surrounded by previous competitors who have finished the race ahead of us, and they have an interest in our achievement. They want to see us finish and experience the benefits that they are now experiencing. So they're cheering us on to the best of their ability. They want us not to quit in the middle of the race, but to press on so that we get to experience all the heavenly blessings that they are now experiencing. The word lay aside means to exercise power of exclusion, where it says to lay aside the encumbrances and to lay aside the sin that entangles us. What it's inviting us to do is to exercise the power of exclusion. In other words, if you're going to run the race with your greatest ability and agility that you can, then you have to learn to know what to say no to. There's some things you're going to have to say no to make sure those things don't get in the way. Because if you start flirting with sin, sin will flirt back, and then it'll take hold of you, and then the process of getting rid of it is so much more complex and involved than saying no to it in the first place. So the warning is, don't get pulled into it, but learn how to say no and learn how to exercise the power of exclusion. If you've ever played a sport before and you excel to a certain level, you know the demands of what's required of you in terms of what you must do to be the best at what you can be and what you have to say no to along the way that's going to hinder you from getting there. John, you played football all through college. You know what I'm talking about. You devote your life to that. And you learn the power of exclusion. It says, lay aside the encumbrances. Be careful your hearts. This is a quote from Jesus, which says, be careful or your hearts will be weighted down with the anxieties of life. Luke 21:34. That's Jesus talking. So when Hebrews 12:1 says, lay aside the encumbrances, what it's saying is, be mindful of those things that wrap themselves around your heart that weigh you down. Those anxieties about everyday things that take hold of you in a way that just burden you and paralyze you and keep you from running with endurance. Anything that hinders you is what that word encumbrance refers to. And it can be good things. It doesn't have to be necessarily bad things. Good things, if given too much power in our lives, can slow us down too much of a if they become too much of a focus. And then the word entangles. Lay aside what encumbers us, and you lay aside what entangles us. And the word entangle means to pull or drag into, kind of like hitting the tar baby. The term has come to refer to a problem that is exacerbated by attempts to struggle with it or by which mere contact can lead to becoming inextricably involved. You know the Uncle Remus story of the tar baby, where the guy comes up to the tar baby and he hits it, and his hand sticks to it. So he tries to get that hand free by hitting the tar baby with the other hand, and then that hand sticks to it. And then he kicks it, and that foot gets stuck. Then before you know it, you're in a pile with the tar baby rolling down the hill. Now, I hate to say this, but I'm going to say it. Sometimes there are people in churches that are tar babies to pastors. They're just trying to pick a fight, and they're just trying to distract the pastor. If you hit them with one hand, they're going to push back. You hit them with another, and then they'll push back, and then you got all the war on your hands, and it's like rolling down the hill with a tar baby. And you got to know when to stay away from these types of personalities that are just mad at life, and they're trying to pick a fight. You know, I've had my share of these. And once you get tangled up with them, it is murder to ever get free. And the word is used here in reference primarily to sin, which starts out so innocent, so easy, and then once you get pulled into it, takes hold of you, and it's really, really, really difficult to shed it from that point. So we are to lay aside, say no to what encumbers us and what entangles us. Fixing our eyes. Now here we want to exercise the power of inclusion. What do we say yes to? Along with what we say no to, what do we say yes to? What we say yes to are those things that enable us to respect and admire and appreciate Jesus and what helps us to keep our eyes upon Him. And the things that help us and enable us to do that, those are things we say yes to. Anything that takes us away, we say no to. Anything that enhances our focus on Jesus, we say yes to. So you say no to things, you got to know what to say no to. You also got to know what to say yes to. And participants in a race don't have time to look around. Eyes must be on the finish line or you'll get left behind or you might get run over. And that's the idea. Fixing our eyes upon Jesus. Now notice that Jesus is given special recognition here in the following way, that the Old Testament saints are behind us, but it's Jesus who's in front of us. Now what do you put your eyes on? The Old Testament saints, it's good to know that they're in the background cheering us on, but that's not where you fix your gaze. They're behind you, but Jesus is in front of you, so you keep your eyes fixed upon Jesus. The Old Testament saints focused on the promises that they never yet realized. But the New Testament saints focus on Jesus, the fulfillment of the promises. They focused on the one who brought fulfillment to all the promises. Hebrews 11:40, where the Hebrew writer says, all those Old Testament saints ran the race, but to them the promise was never fulfilled. But God has something better for us because the promise has been fulfilled. And Jesus is yes and amen to all the promises that we find in the Bible. The word author means originator, architect. Our faith begins with Him, same root word for architect as I mentioned earlier. Perfecter or completer, the one our faith ends with. It begins with Him, it ends with Him. And if Jesus is the architect and the builder of our faith, then He is the one who deserves our attention. So let's put our faith, put our eyes upon Him. And as long as our eyes upon Him, if He's the one who's begun our faith and wants to complete it, He's not going to do anything to damage it. Keeping your eyes upon Jesus is the most constructive thing you can do for your faith. Taking your eyes off of Jesus is when you run into trouble. Keeping your eyes on Jesus, He's your biggest cheerleader. He's the one who is going to make sure your faith gets you to the finish line. And so when our eyes are upon Him, it's always to the advantage of our faith. Jesus is the supreme leader and ultimate model. He overcame the highest degree of difficulty to achieve the greatest accomplishment. He went from the cross to the throne. From the depths of the pain of this fallen world to the right hand of God of the throne in heaven. What an amazing distance that He went. So spiritual growth is enhanced through the power of focus. And our faith is enhanced through the power of focus. The word illumination needs to lay aside, and laying things aside is what leads to the greatest freedom. When we say no to things, we're freest to run with the greatest sense of freedom. Encumbrances, sin that ensnares, we are to eliminate anything that cumbers us, anything that snares us, and we're to concentrate or fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who had to suffer the cross in order to sit upon the throne, and He did that through endurance. Hated the shame of the cross, but delighted in the right hand of God. He hated the process, but loved the result. Now, notice the way this is being spoken of here. What the passage is talking about is how athletes are successful. Here's what you have to do to be successful. First of all, you have to be free to give yourself fully to what you're going to do. Then you have to exercise the power of focus. You focus on the finish line with the greatest freedom possible, which enables you to run the race without any encumbrance or inhibition. And then once you start the race, the way you're going to finish is through endurance. You're going to run into hills and valleys and mountains along the way, bends and curves in the road. The weather won't always be conducive to running. You're going to hit this stuff along the way. But with endurance, that's what takes you from the beginning point to the end point. So if we're going to get in the race, the way we're going to experience the freedom to run is by elimination, what to say no to. The way we have the inspiration to keep going is to focus on the finish line. In this case, it's on Jesus. And then between us and the finish line, we endure, hating the things that hold us up, but delighting in the idea that once we get past them, there's such a great reward waiting for us. So life, sometimes we have to hate the process, but love the result of where we're going to go. So, give you a quick analogy. Lions and lion trainers, do you know why lion trainers put four-legged stools in the face of a lion? You know why they do that? Pardon? Confuse them? Well, what happens is, what happens is this. It's fascinating. When you put a four-legged stool in the face of a lion, the lion tries to focus on all four legs at once and can't focus on any of them, and it neutralizes their power. That's what this verse is saying. Is if you get trying to focus on too many things and you get your eyes off Jesus, it's going to neutralize your ability to run the race. It's the power of focus. So when he's saying here, fix your eyes upon Jesus, that empowers you to run in the greatest possible way. Don't allow yourself to get distracted by all of the complexities of life. The lion trainer comes up to the lion, sticks a stool in his face, and that big, powerful lion tries to focus on all four legs at once and can't focus on any of them. And it's neutralized. Can't hurt him. I don't know who figured that out, but that's ingenious. Rabbits and greyhounds. Why do they put the rabbit in front of the greyhound running around the track? Because it makes the rabbit run, it makes the greyhound run faster when the rabbit's out there in front. They had this big greyhound track down by 275 in Tampa, and I never went the whole time I was there, but they had those rabbits in front of it, and it's the lure that helps the dogs focus to run faster. So when you put your eyes on Jesus who's out in front of you, it makes you run faster. It's a motivation and incentive. High definition spiritual growth is accomplished by looking to Jesus who brings the highest possible clarity or definition to our journey. We use the term high definition to refer to clear pictures on a television. And if you've ever bought the latest upgrade and you take your old equipment off and you got this certain quality of picture and then you put the new equipment on, all of a sudden you could see with so much more clarity. And the clarity was always there, you just couldn't see it. So when we focus on Jesus, that's called high definition spiritual growth. It's clear growth because you're focusing upon Jesus, and that's what the race is all about, becoming like Him and running into His arms as He's in heaven. These are simple analogies, but it makes the point. Looking to Jesus brings the highest possible clarity or definition to our journey. Now here's a quote or two. The greatest weakness of people, according to Henry Ford, is to try to do too many things at once. It burdens you and it slows you down. The power of focus is what the Hebrews author was talking about. So when we try to do too many things at once, and we get ourselves involved in this ministry and that ministry and that program and the other program and going to church 8 times a week and all that other stuff, ultimately that doesn't help you. It's too much. So you've got to make sure that you run the race with basically what you need and learn to say no to some really good things. That's okay to do that. In churches that expect their members to be here 8 nights a week, don't do anybody any favors. That's not healthy. Clarity in leadership circles today means to be free from anything that obscures, blocks, distorts, or darkens. Clouded vision always leads to mediocre results. As a leader, as a church leader, I've learned the hard way that if I'm trying to lead people down a pathway and I'm not clear what the pathway is, we're going to have a much bumpier ride. But if I'm disciplined enough to figure out exactly where I want to take people before I get people moving in a direction, the ride is much, much smoother if I start from a clear position. And so this is what's exercised today in leadership circles of companies and business and so forth. This term clarity has begun to be used very extensively because it refers to clear thinking leaders who know where they're going and what they're doing. So when the Hebrew author says, fix your eyes upon Jesus, that's where you get the highest definition of clarity spiritually, when your eyes upon Him. Not upon you, not upon your failures, not upon somebody who seems to be doing so much better than you're doing, not upon any of those things, but fix your eyes upon Jesus. That's where high definition clarity spiritually, in spiritual terms, comes from. Remember the hymn, turn your eyes upon Jesus, look full in His wonderful face, and the things of the earth grow strangely dim in the light of His glory and grace. That's brilliant. That is totally brilliant. And we sing that song. Turn your eyes upon Jesus, look full in His wonderful face. Things of earth will go strangely dim in the light of His glory and grace. That's what's being said here. So, here's the primary imperative of the passage. Is these Hebrew folks had just kind of gotten distracted, bogged down, encumbered, and they weren't running the race very well. So he says to them, you're not going to shrink back to the ruination of your soul, but you're going to move forward to the preservation of your soul. The way you're going to do that is by faith. By faith, all these Old Testament people did all these amazing things. Let's go back and take a walk down memory lane for just a minute here. And he cites all these people. And then he gets to Hebrews 12, and he says, now, here's how you do it. Here's what you've moved away from. We're surrounded by this marvelous cloud of witnesses who are like a big single sky looking down upon us. These are people that have run their race. These aren't spectators that have never played the game. They've played the game and won. There's a lot of sports fans today who are sports fans of sports they never played. They don't know a thing about it. Not these people. They have played the game and they finish. They've got their championship trophy and they're upper stand saying, go, 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 don't stop. Don't give up. So we were surrounded by this great cloud of witnesses. Therefore, let us, following their example, lay aside anything that slows us down. Let's have maximum freedom to run the race. Let's fix our eyes upon Jesus, which gives us that high clarity of definition. That's the goal line. And then we are going to fix our eyes upon Jesus, and we're going to run this race with endurance. We ain't giving up. We're not stopping. We're not quitting. We're going to get to the finish line. And the author, Jesus, the one whom we have our eyes upon, He architected, He built, He's going to complete our faith. And if we keep our eyes upon Him, remembering all that He went through, no matter what we encounter, we won't get discouraged and quit. If Jesus is our example, we're never going to go through anything that is even close to what He went through. And with our eyes upon Him, we will handle anything that comes our way. There you go. So, fixing our eyes upon Jesus. Here's concept 33. Finishing the race requires freedom from distraction, focus on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, and Christ-like endurance to finish the course. Concept 33. Now, what we hope to do from here, we're going to take a break for a week. Kind of sorry I said that. Y'all want to meet next week? Because now this is fun to talk about. No, let's take a break and we'll come back to it. Here's what we're going to do. Now that your faith is alive and operational, and you've got this object you're going to focus on, we're going to start talking about Jesus, this wonderful, magnificent, amazing person. And let's develop our understanding of who our model is. Who is that one who is the architect and perfecter of our faith? Let's learn to focus on Him. And then as we pass through life, we don't wave to all the people up in the stands and spectating. You keep your eyes upon Him. And He's going to get you to the finish line. And He'll get you there with flair. You'll finish in a way that finishes with a flurry of trumpets. And you'll cross that finish line just like you see those runners cross that finish line with their arms in the air, so excited that they finish. You will get to the finish line. If, Kirk, you don't take your eyes off Jesus. You take your eyes off Jesus, you got a losing proposition. And that's what the Hebrew church did. They lost sight of their goal. So, living by faith and keeping our eyes upon Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, we're in great shape. And a healthy spirituality develops from here when we keep our eyes upon Him. All right, guys, y'all been a great audience. Let's take a break. See you in 2 weeks. And we will come back and talk about this Jesus upon whom we're supposed to focus our attention. Have a great couple weeks. We'll see you soon. Next Sunday is the Time Change Sunday. Get an extra hour of sleep. Don't forget that.